The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back.
Main Street, Wall Street. Hey, it's top of the second hour of National Intel Report, live on Republic Broadcasting Network, Liberty Lighthouse, on Mojo 50 Radio, WPN 324 Talk Radio, and Patriot Nation Radio Network. I am your Thursday host, Peter Serafine. Remember, free speech is not free. Support this free speech network. Donate if you can. Buy their merchandise. Support the network sponsors. And on the phone with us now, Mr. Lance Hilsinger, author of Build a Better Bridge and retired child protection services social worker. Now, I know it's different from state to state. Is it CPS in California where you are, Lance?
CPS is the generic term. We used child welfare services.
Child welfare. See, here in Pennsylvania where I am, it's CYS, the Children and Youth Services. But yeah,
yeah, hey. Part of my first book, In Place of the Parent, Inside Child Protective Services, talks about the different acronyms that are used. The Department of Children and Family Services is one common one that's used in many states. In many states, child welfare is administered at the state level. There's state employees. California and some other states, it's administered at the county level, but supervised by the state capital.
All right. Hey, well, let's tell our listeners before we go. All right, so here, let's be honest. I have a habit of running off at the mouth and forgetting to give you opportunity to plug your work. So, first, why don't you start by telling our listeners why you are an expert on the subject and where they can find your book?
Well, my name again is Lance Hilsinger. I have a degree in psychology and political science from UCLA, a master's degree in psychology from Vanderbilt University. I've been qualified as an expert witness in juvenile court about 75 times. I have been was a child welfare social worker for 34 years, first five in Los Angeles County. All but 1 year, I had court cases. So every court case that I dealt with, which children going into foster, either foster care in foster homes or foster care within relatives. In retirement, I wanted to do something to still make the world a better place. So my first book, In Place of the Parent, Inside Child Protective Services, gives the history of child welfare, how that has changed over the years, for good and for bad, mostly for good, but not universally for good. And I wanted to improve that system in particular. And then, of course, child welfare is part of the larger social welfare system. And anybody who's in child welfare for years knows much about this, what we think of the welfare system. Food stamps, cash aid, that kind of stuff. Subsidized housing. I dealt with quite a bit of subsidized housing issues as a social worker. So that, I believe, makes me a relative expert on things. And like I said, I wrote both books with the idea of just making a constructive purpose, trying to give ideas to make the world a little bit better place.
And where can we find those books?
Oh, thank you. In Place of the Parent is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the major outlets. Build a Better Bridge is available on Kindle Unlimited and also available in print from Amazon. And my website is LanceHilsinger.net. That's LanceHilsinger.net.
LanceHilsinger.net. Now, you were kind enough to provide me a copy of Build a Better Bridge. And I feel I need to warn you about our audience. I am a small government, far-right conservative, get the government out of my life kind of person. And I venture to guess that the large majority of our audience is the same way. I read your book in the last few days. It's a very short book, very easy to read, very well researched. You used your you used your personal experiences, you know, an appropriate amount. You didn't, you know, fill it full of anecdotal personal stories. You used ones that were appropriate for the point you were trying to make, and that was it. You clearly identified many of the problems with the welfare systems. I disagree with almost every one of your proposed solutions, though.
Well, as I said in the book, few readers will agree with all the ideas that I propose, but if True. You agree with one or two of them and you're in a position to do something, well, go for that one.
All right, let me clarify. There was one thing that you said that I completely 100% agreed with, and you even made me look at it in a different way, and that was your border policy. The fact that the idea of a liberal border raises housing prices and lowers wages and does all of these other things that, you know, directly impact the welfare system. I hadn't even thought about the real estate value side of it. Of course, everybody thinks about the wages side of it. I never thought about the real estate side of it. And I'm like, wow, that's a good point. So let's talk about it for a couple of seconds. You pick one of the ideas in the book that you're willing to disclose to people that have not yet bought the book.
Well, one of the things I make an emphasis about is fathers. The fathers in my case, well, in a very non-professional term, so many of them were losers. Very few of them were really abusers in the sense of when people think of child abuse and child maltreatment, they think of somebody, you know, beating a kid. Those are relatively few number of our cases. Most of our cases were due to neglect, due to just substance abuse. And very often, like something might occur in the mother's home with the boyfriend, and the absent father is there, you know, out of the picture or not in the picture, where is he? You know, and sometimes we could release the child to the responsible dad, but that was really an exception. Most of the time, there were so many of our fathers that were incarcerated, had criminal records, or just didn't graduate from high school. Just had a little struggle meeting their needs. And so that's one of the themes I want to make, is how we can get men to be more successful in life. There's lots of attention in the media about disparity of top jobs, that men have most of the top jobs and women kind of have to fight for those top jobs. And there's truth to that. There's also the opposite truth, is that men are disproportionately in the lower part of society. For each woman that's incarcerated, roughly 10 men are incarcerated.
Right, for, and men have like a 6 times higher suicide rate, and we die younger, and yeah.
We die younger, and especially the suicide rate for suicide is the third leading cause of death for men 30 to 39, but it's ninth the leading cause of death for women, the same age group. So what are we doing in our society failing to do, to get men to be more responsible, both as taxpayers, as citizens, as fathers, as all those things. And that's the theme in my book. And just to add one more thing is, like, in housing, you know, the people who are really out on the street, yeah, there are families that are out on the street that are literally living in tents and what have you. But the single person who is homeless, truly homeless, that is almost always a man that's living on by the creek or under the overpass or whatever. And why was that man not successful?
Down by the river.
What?
I said, in a van down by the river. It's old Saturday Night Live. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Okay,
go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you first.
Well, there's two things that I think. One is that we need to identify that boys don't graduate at school as often as girls. And particularly true, this is white boys don't graduate often as white girls. Black African-American boys don't graduate as often as white girls, but the difference is it's even greater. And in college, African-American women make about 12-13% of the college population, which is roughly the population in the in the national average. But it's about a third of that for African-American men. Why aren't men being more successful? And I don't say I have all the answers to that, but one of the answers is that we need to identify that as a problem. And I call for in the book that school districts break down the graduation rate by gender, that you can't do anything about it until you identify the problem. And just highlighting that, that's and I know your listeners are all conservative, or most of them, and they don't want government to be spending money, but, you know, a website to show how many boys graduate versus girls, that's a cheap thing. That's a cheap solution. And you've got to help identify the problem.
Yeah, that's something the school secretary do on graduation day, just sit there with a ticker, boy, girl, boy, girl, 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 boy, boy. Like, yeah, there's no cost to that, no real cost to that.
And if I could share one personal anecdote to sort of emphasize this point, my daughter was in the band in high school, and so we would go to the football game and watch her in the band. And, you know, for homecoming, they would have the boys and girls that are made the homecoming court, and they interview them during the halftime. And the girls would say, you know, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be an engineer. The boys would say, oh, I like my grandmother's spaghetti, or I collect Pokemon cards. The difference between was just embarrassing as a man. It really was. So I just want to share that anecdotal point. As far as the government policy issue, another thing I say in the book is that if you're 90% of children on welfare are in, the father's not at home. There's the absent father. And if he's an absent father that has got a decent job, he's paying child support directly to the mother, and that she doesn't get any cash aid. So let's say she's a woman, she has two children, one by a successful guy or marginally pretty successful guy, another by sort of a deadbeat kind of guy or marginally employed guy. That marginally employed guy has no incentive for his kids. Is that if he earns some money, his child support collect goes back to reimburse the government for the cash aid the mom receives. Now, that sounds logical. Governments give mom money, and we get a little money from dad. Let's just use that to offset. But that revenue stream, you can't find it. If you try to look for that revenue stream in government, you know, expenditure charts and revenue charts, you can't find it. It's so small. But if he could, this guy who's marginally employed, who can work, you've got to get him into the regular economy. And if he's in the regular economy and his money goes to his kids, he's going to be far more motivated to be a responsible citizen. Yeah. So It's penny wise and pound foolish to say, okay, we're not going to give you the child support. If you're marginally more employed man, we want you to be more and more into the mainstream. Any child support, we're going to go to your poverty is going to live just a little bit better. So that's one of those. Those are the two main points I have here.
Okay. Well, I want to give my anecdotal story about child support. I've been paying child support for 27 years now. I have a lot of children. When the very first child support case, my wife and I break up, she moves to Minnesota, where her family was from, takes the kids with her, goes through the child support court system, the ERISA or whatever it's called, that when it crosses state lines. The judge in Alabama, where I'm living, creates the new support order, and I'm pretty quick on my feet. He tells me how much I've got to pay, and he even breaks it down to by the week for me, since I get paid by the week. I thought that was nice. I did some quick math, and I tell him, once he gives me the dollar numbers, like, Your Honor, that leaves me with $70 a week, which, by the way, is the amount of the rent on my drafty, nappy, falling apart trailer. And he said, I know, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do about it. I have to go by these guidelines. So here I am, full-time employed, making money, and they made me pretty darn close to homeless. And had I become homeless, now, how would that have affected my children and the ex-wife and all of that? Of course, they would have got nothing because I'm not working. But anyway, I'm basically trying to agree that there are problems with the system, that it is not fair to either party. It's just not equitable. But this is a live call-in show, and we have Andrea in Oklahoma on line 3. Andrea, welcome to National Intel Report.
Yes. Since Biden closed down the Keystone Pipeline and has sold off the reserves to other countries, and So that means there's an end in sight of no more gas. Any suggestions of what that's going to look like? Because at this point, I've gone to, we have some big gas stations here in Oklahoma, and they keep building more gas stations. But, some of them have all the pumps with, bags over them, and there's nothing. So, and I lived through that time whenever the gas was low, and you had to go by your license plate. If it was odd, you went on odd days, and if it was even, you went on even days. But if there's no gas being produced at all, should we all start getting an electrical bike or something and plugging it in?
Well, Lance, I've got to tell you, I'm not really an expert on petroleum policy. I can't address anything like that. And I can tell you child support system, and I can tell you some about child welfare system, some about child support, because I dealt with that from time to time. And we had a good
Lance,
system.
I think she's holding over from the first hour. The first hour of the show, I was talking about government involvement in business and industry.
Okay.
And I think that's a holdover call. But, we all know that draining our strategic oil reserves at a time when our oil-producing nations of the Middle East are refusing to play nice is not necessarily a good strategic move. And, if the oil reserves down to nothing, we could end up to the gas rationing thing like we had in the late 70s where it went by your license, whatever.
If nobody's producing gas, if he shut down the main thing that's giving gas to the whole United States and nobody's selling us gas, I guess we're all going to be walking or trying to pedal bikes or something. I mean, we can't really go to war if we're, we seem like we keep raveling our swords and stuff. And I'm sorry that is terrible that 27 years of child support. I knew the judge only gave me $100 a month and I never got $100 for my son. I just had to deal with doing it myself.
Supply. My oldest daughter just turned 30, and my youngest just turned 18, and he graduates high school this year. So this coming year, my child support will stop finally after 27 years. I will see an entire paycheck to myself.
Oh my gosh! Well, congratulations! The light at the end of the tunnel, and then there won't be any gas.
Oh
my gosh!
Good.
Well, anyway, I see this as a horrible thing, considering everybody usually drives 20 miles to work, and it there's just no way everything's going to shut down to nothing just with that one thing alone, and then there's no electricity. And I'm sorry, I'm interrupting everything that's going on. Thank you for your time. Bye.
Thank you very much for the call, Andrea. Always appreciate calls. And before we get back to Lance Hilsinger, let's run a little this one.
Do you feel that your neighbors should pay for your overpriced, worthless college degree? Do you think some guns should be banned just because they look scary? Do you believe the phrase "all lives matter" is racist, but "Black Lives Matter" is social justice? Are fascist tactics acceptable when used for anti-fascist causes? If you answered yes to any of these questions, you may be one of the almost 50% of Americans suffering from a disease known as liberal progressivism. Recognizing the early warning signs is the key to recovery. A few of the early warning signs are feeling offended by 100-year-old statutes, the desire to silence opposing opinions, and blindly following edicts without question. There is hope. A complete recovery may still be possible. A little pill called Liberty is the key to healing. Combine liberty in a cocktail of common sense and personal responsibility, and liberal progressivism is reversible. Liberal progressivism is a serious disease and should be treated immediately. This message brought to you by the Founding Fathers in conjunction with the United States Constitution. The United States of America is the greatest country in the history of the world.
I probably shouldn't have played that one, not knowing you very well, Lance, but, sorry. I agree with you. The fatherless homes is a huge problem. And of course, you know, if I've been paying child support for 27 years, I was a part of that problem.
Well, there's fathers that are not in the home, but are still actively involved. And I think that makes all the difference in the world.
It's hard to be actively involved from over 1,000 miles away. But anyway, I agree with you is what I was getting to. Fatherless homes is a huge part of the problem. Where I disagree with what you said in your book is solutions. What, if anything, can the government do about it? And my answer to that is nothing. It is not the government's job or responsibility. It is entirely the destruction of the social community, the church community. You made a good point about faith in the book as well, about that people of faith, any faith, do better. They pull themselves out of the poverty better. They just do better in life in general. But our government as a whole, you know, blanket statements are never completely accurate, but, you know, as a whole, our government seems to be trying to do away with that connection that we all know is beneficial. How do we get that back?
Well, I think that, you know, I think there's some change going on. I don't know so much in government. I can't think of something, but I think in advertising, there's a lot of things about, you know, if you look back, one of the things that I talk about in the book is the Jetsons, you know,
right.
the you know, and then in the future in the Jetsons, you know, you know, the work was done by robots. The mom would stay at home. There was a maid at home. And it was very much nuclear family. Now, it was also one of the things that I recognize is that it's an all white cartoon. And then, of course, you know, we see that what we see, and understandably, African Americans will say, hey, where am I in the cartoon? And that's important. And I think that sometimes commercials today put the dad down. If you see a commercial about the bad financial advisor, the devious financial person, it's obviously a white male.
What? Are you saying that maybe Hollywood is pushing that masculinity is bad and white men in particular are bad? I find that
I don't want to put it in terms like that. I think they just go with the flow, and that's
right.
And so going with the flow makes it look. And what I say by looking better, when originally, like, a lot of these ads came out for, you know, online colleges and everything, it was almost always a woman going to college was featured in the ad. Now I've seen these ads, they've branched out, they've done better. One of the changes has been is like ABC Mouth, which sponsors one of the sponsors on PBS. Originally, their commercials that they run before the show would show a girl playing semi-science toys. Now they have boys. So I do think it's starting to go back. I do think there's a recognition that dads are important. I talk about in the book how the two-parent... Now, we don't want anybody to stay in a relationship that's violent just for economic reasons. You know, I just want to say that out there. I'm not encouraging people to stay in a relationship that's making them miserable and their children are miserable. But one of the things I point out in the book is we could teach the economics of two-parent families in high school. That wouldn't be teaching morality, but just that.
You mean teaching something useful?
Yeah.
I agree with you. I think teaching the economics of how to run a household and how it is easier as a two-family household would be a beneficial thing.
Yeah. And I go into details in the book about how much that leaves the dad to pay, like you were saying. You know, after you pay rent and child support, you know, what do you have left for food?
Right.
And that encourages people to find extra legal means to support themselves.
Yeah.
And so.
And if dad goes out and gets a second job, they raise his child support. So it's not worth it. So instead of going working 40 hours a week, now I'm working 60, but my child support went up anyway. Anyway, it's break time. We'll be back in 3 minutes with Lance Hilsinger, author of Build a Better Bridge.
homeowners. Are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee by going to rbnhemppaste.com and ordering a trial pack of Happy Packets for $5 with free shipping. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
Tune in Saturday mornings, 8 to 10 Central, to the Alternative Media with your host, Farron. If you've not been listening, this is some of what you've been missing.
2,000 mules, like you like to say occasionally, Farron, in your face.
They might have a set of lactating mammaries available that could provide milk for their adopted children.
Complicit news media, all pulling off this gigantic fraud.
Rhino, neocon, cucks.
There's this wonderful thing that's called Vote With Your Feet. Move to California.
I am a conspiracy factualist, and everyone else is a reality theorist.
Hundreds, if not thousands, of ships came out of nowhere.
Give me liberty or let's give you death.
Any excuse to go in and kill yourself for this fraud of a government. This goes back 100 years.
When they come for your gold, give them a lead. And when they come for your guns, give them the bullets first. And God help us all.
When it gets cold outside and you got nobody to love, you'll understand.
To the final segment, National Intel Report for this Thursday, October 27th. I'm, of course, Peter, and on the line with us is, I forgot, Lance. Could not remember your first name for a second. I wanted to say Alan. Lance Hilsinger, author of Build a Better Bridge. All right, Lance, here's my problem with the entire welfare system that we have today. You see, as the insider who worked in the system, ways to make the system better. I see a failed system that needs to be torn down and rebuilt. The great society of LBJ, the war on poverty declared in 1964, first started spending in 1965. We have spent $23 trillion on the war on poverty. And at the time, in 1964, when he declared the war on poverty, there were roughly 34 million people that the administration identified as poor. And the goal was to make that number zero. And here it is now, and we have, I want to say, 68 million people receiving government aid in one of these social programs. We're still spending gobs and gobs and gobs of money, and it has made almost an imperceptible difference on the poverty level as a percentage of the whole population. So it's not working.
As a percentage, the poverty level is less than it was. I don't remember. I quoted in the book. I don't remember from verbatim exact figures. But prior to the war on poverty, it was something in the neighborhood of the high teens. And I think with the social welfare frictions, it's now in the low teens. Some progress there. If we suddenly were to say no welfare checks go out tomorrow morning, what would happen? People would be evicted. We'd have more people, we'd have people begging on the streets. When I in San Luis Obispo, there occasionally see beggars. We're a fairly affluent community here, but beggars on the streets are almost always men. But once in a while, I see a family. If you were to suddenly say, okay, nothing, yeah, some people might lift themselves up, but also, you're going to see more families. We're going to look like a third world country. One of the things
I don't think anybody's trying to make it go away. I don't think anybody wants to make welfare just stop. We have a moral obligation to help the poor, to help the poor. But help is a two-way thing. You can't continuously give money to somebody year after year after year after year. Like, there has to be... I see, as an outsider looking in, because I've never qualified, I've never accepted a dime, I've never been on... I was unemployed for, 3 months in my life. I didn't qualify for unemployment. I was homeless. I dumpster dive looking for the sack of oranges that the grocery store threw out because one of the oranges was rotten and was happy to find it. I have been that poor. I have never received unemployment, welfare, housing. I've never received any of that stuff. And I now consider myself strongly in the middle class. Because I worked for it. Now, I understand, opportunity. I got lucky a couple of times, helped me out a lot in my climb up the ladder. But shouldn't welfare social programs be designed in such a way to end at some point, to give these people the tools to get off of them?
There's a five-year limit. There's a five-year limit under Clinton's reform. There's a five-year limit.
Okay.
And so that
when the 5 years is up, are these people just on the street, or are they actually getting somewhere?
Well, they can take advantage. You can have a deferral of one year to get the vocational training. And I argue in the book that 1 year really doesn't get that person off of poverty. You know, you're not going to get a job, especially like in an expensive area like San Luis Obispo. A job that you have 1 year of junior college is going to earn you money. It's not going to be a place where the studio apartment goes for $1,800 a month. You know, you're not going to be able to earn that.
But that's my problem right there. That entire thing right there is my problem. Why do they have to stay in San Luis Obispo? Why does every taxpayer in the entire nation have to pay for that person's decision to live someplace where it's so expensive?
Well, that's a good point.
I have no education. I have high school education and not a minute of any education outside, beyond high school, and I make almost $75,000 a year.
Yeah.
It
can be done, and I think that people need to follow the jobs. You have, people have family ties that want to stay in the area, and if you've ever lived on the Central Coast, people will say, I don't want to live here, even if I'm in poverty. but I do think that, helping people move to where they would be financially independent, I think that there's a role of government for that, and that there's a way to do that. Yeah. Yes, I think that maybe we could have a government, increase the system where you could move to out of state, move to a job if a company is hiring factory workers in Kentucky, and you give somebody a bonus if they move to Kentucky. There's, and a bonus, but a reward or incentive or something to do that. That may be in some evening out between the states. I think that there could be some program, some adaption there. How many people take advantage of it? People have family ties. They have whatever. People do not move simply because of economic decision. And are you going to, so that's one of the things that fall back. And I had cases where I would advise people, Fresno is not too far from us, about 100 miles away. It's much cheaper to live in Fresno. And I advised some of the parents, like, hey, so we'll move to Bakersfield or Fresno, where it's cheaper to live, and that if you're still making $17 an hour, that can go further towards rent than San Luis Obispo. Very few people took that up on me. They were wanted to be where they were, and you can't.
Well, I want to be in Fiji.
Move to another place. Yeah. Well, and I told that to someone. I had someone who said we were meeting, and they said they needed some help, and I said, you know, on a social worker salary, I'd like to live in Malibu, but I can't. You know, you know, that's reality. No, I wouldn't move to Malibu if I could, but I was making the point. And
right. I think that's a big part of it. I think that goes back to education as well. So we don't teach, you know, real home economics anymore. Like, you know, how kids don't know what they don't understand what the college student loan is going to end up costing them in the long term. I mean, one of my kids just started at Penn State, $20,000 a year as a freshman. And oh, by the way, if you take that as a student loan and you defer it until after college, it's now $40,000 before you even have a job. But they're not taught that in high school.
Right, and having two having put two through college on a social worker salary, yeah. Yeah, that was a lot. It's a lot. And so, then I argue in my book, they have these programs where if you're a teacher or a medical professional, you work in an underserved area, you get so much of your student loan forgiven. Well, I say let everybody who works in an underprivileged room get a certain, you know, you work a year, you get 10% off or 50% or something, you know, off. So that encourages to bring your entrepreneurship, your work ethic, everything you know about, it just brings more, you know, it brings something to that underprivileged community. And the person gets the student loan debt, you know, from a bit excused.
I would be much better with that. If we were helping to, you know, gradually relieve somebody's student loan because they were doing something good for society, you know, working in the starting a business in an underprivileged community or working in a needed career field. Yeah, sure. That's helping the greater society. I'd be a lot better than this blanket student loan forgiveness stuff that they're trying to do now. So in my quick research, there's like 68 million people receiving assistance of some type in our country. Does that sound
close to me? I said 70 million in my book if you include the elderly. Now, a lot of people focus when they talk about poor. You know, 9% of seniors are on food stamps. So, right. You know, we have to figure that in the poverty calculations as well. And you can't, you know, you're not going to get a lot of tax dollars out of somebody who's a senior citizen on food stamps.
Okay, so let's say 70 million people. If that's the number you used in your book, you got 70 million people on whatever.
Yeah.
How many taxpayers were there last year?
You know, that's something I don't know.
125. Yeah. So you got 125 million people in this country that are supporting themselves, their own families, their churches, their charities, and whatever, plus 70 million other people. Do you see why the conservative has a problem with this entire system?
I mentioned that in the book. I talked about the resentment somebody would have when they're trying to pay, you know, pay for their own kids' college education that they got to pay for somebody else's, you know, right. Because they're getting in tuition free because they come from whatever. And a point I didn't make in the book, but a point I made in my local community here is that, you know, they started charging about 10, 15 years ago for the school bus. If your kids took the school bus to school, you had to pay so many hundreds of dollars a year per child. And, yeah, because the schools didn't have enough, you know, so you had to pay. Now, if you're on food stamps or one of the, you know, welfare, you didn't have to pay, obviously. There was no money to collect. And I don't have a problem if my kids, you know, if there's 48 kids on the bus, that contribute to pay for the two other kids, that's okay. But when it gets to what if it's 30 paying kids and 20 non-paying kids, or 20 paying kids and 30 paying non-paying kids? That's the problem I have, and that's And that's one of the things I talk about in the book is demographics. You can say it's a failed policy or, you know, equivalent with this policy or that policy, but demographics is one of the things that's changing, is that women who are college educated have a negative birth rate. They have approximately 1.9 children, you know, per woman per her lifetime. A girl, a young woman who's got just a high school, I should say, young woman, a woman in her lifetime who just has a high school diploma is more likely to have 3 children or more. And so that over time is just out there. And I think that there, I argue in the book, let's use a way to incentive that if you're already poor and you don't yet have children, let's not add a child. How are we going to incentivize that? How do we say, and plenty of poor people recognize that they can't afford children. I mean, lots of people put off having children that are middle class until they get a little bit better financial shape, or they buy a house or pay off the car loan or whatever. And many people are responsible. How do we increase that number of people who, before the child was born in the welfare role? You know, and that's a very challenge to do that in a way that's constitutional.
I don't know. I think we go back to, again, education. Why? This needs, instead of teaching, you know, the critical race theory and the, you know, the social stuff that really is not valuable as a whole in any way other than manipulating society, how about teaching, you know, again, home economics? Hey, look, this is what it costs to run a house when you get out of high school. And if you have a baby, it's going to cost this much more. And it, you know, if daddy leaves, it's going to be all on you. Or, you know, yeah. I think
you don't want to make, you know,
huge
you want to
portion of this goes back to kids, education.
You want to do it in a way that makes kids, you know, not to sound preachy to them, because that'll turn them off right away. You can't sound preachy to teenagers. you gotta sell it in some other fashion. But yes, that's the thing. That'd be practical.
So we need to do it in 1 minute TikTok videos.
Pardon?
So we need to do it in 1 minute TikTok videos.
And some sort of TikTok videos, I don't know. Yeah. I think there are a lot of bright kids out there, but there are bright kids that don't have the same, you know, practical knowledge that I think that at a similar age that kids that I had. And how do you do that without, you know, morality and rectory and all the things that you don't want to do? I don't think that most of the schools, you know, they're teaching, you know, the regular history, they're teaching math, and you teach it in a different way. I do think the textbooks, one of the things I had a beef with was that when my daughters were in junior high, they studied world history, they had world history at junior high level. There was something about Islam, or, you know, the five pillars of Islam, and they talked about that. That's very important. You have to, kids need to know about one of the major religions in the world. But there was nothing about Christianity.
Right. And I brought that up with one of my kids' schools recently, too. They did reference both Islam and Christianity, but it was like 3 pages on Islam and like half a page on Christianity. And I was like, no. It's just not right. Anyway, let's do this final break. Just be back in just 30, 60 seconds. I forget how long this one is.
'Twas the night before Christmas. The kids snuggled asleep in their beds when you heard a loud rumble, like Santa and his sled. So you went downstairs to take a peek, get a look. You were confronted by this creep, a crook. He drew his weapon, but you fired first. And now this creep could take all your worth. Secure your family with Right to Bear insurance. Plans start at $10.95 a month, with civil and criminal defense coverage options up to $2 million.
Visit liberty-lighthouse.com/right-to-bear to learn more, or to sign up and start protecting what you have now.
If you own a firearm anywhere in the nation, I highly recommend Right to Bear insurance. liberty-lighthouse.com/right-to-bear to learn more. Lance, I want to tell you, I enjoyed your book, and I want listeners out there, you should get his book, Build a Better Bridge. Even if you don't agree with his proposed solutions, he really does a great job of identifying some of the problems, and maybe you've got a better idea. And Lance, I don't want to sound like I'm arguing with you about everything that you were talking about, but I have a personal resentment toward the entire welfare system, because I came from a broken home. I, you know,
didn't, my family never owned a house. We rented. I lived in four different states and went to four different high schools before I graduated high school. I was the epitome of a kid that should have been on welfare as far as, you know, the metrics and whatever. But I got my first job when I was 14 years old, and I haven't been unemployed except for that 3 months when I was homeless. That was my own stupid fault. I quit a job because the boss pissed me off. I was still young and stupid. And I quit my job in the hospitality industry in a non-tourist town in the winter when no hospitality industries are hiring. So it was my own fault. And because I quit, I couldn't qualify for anything, but I still got out of it myself. And now I own a house. I own three cars. But I think a lot of it is education. I have a, you know, my cell phone plan is $25 a month, and I have a $100 cell phone or $150 cell phone. I don't have the latest and greatest $1,000 iPhone. I don't have a 60-inch flat screen TV because it was there and it was cheap. My newest car is 10 years old. I'm sorry, 11 years old now. My pickup truck is 28 years old. A lot of the people today that run out and lease a new vehicle every 3 years and buy the latest and greatest gadget every time they turn around, and then you see them using a freaking Snap card at the grocery store. And that pisses me off.
I don't know that anybody... Well, what I want to say is that you were a particularly resilient person. You were particularly resilient. Statistically, somebody who's been dealt a bad card in life, the average person, this is what I talk a lot about. We have to think about not someone who's exceptionally resilient, because I've seen people who were very, very resilient, and other people who just like had what I thought looked like an ordinary problem, just fall pieces. So people vary a lot on their resilience scale, and so we have to think about the average ability of resilience and the average ability of motivation, the average ability of impulse control. So that's where you have to kind of set policy and not say we wish every one of the truisms in social work is that you deal with people how they are, not how you want them to be. Yes, everyone should be more resilient. Everyone should have good impulse control, but people don't. And so we have to adopt, whether it's in a clinical setting or in a policy setting, accept that that's how people are. I think during the pandemic, you saw in some states people driving fancy cars to food banks.
Yeah.
And I know that people were appalled by that. But the backstory on that is that people you have a minimum amount of assets you can have to qualify for food stamps. If you have a car that's worth $20,000, and even though you're behind in payments because you lost your job because of the pandemic, you still have assets in that car, and that can disqualify someone for food stamps. So that person driving up to the food bank and waiting in a long line with that nice car, you think, God, are they taking advantage of the system? No. I mean, perhaps some are. But some are also just because they couldn't qualify. And the other thing I want to point out is that the state systems were overwhelmed by the food stamps, unemployment compensation. You know, we had a big thing in California here about unemployment insurance, people not getting them. There was plenty of fraud there, people trying to take advantage of the system. The bad people in society were trying to, you know, rip off government. And the good people who just fell into hard times weren't getting the money they need. Both things were occurring. One of the things that point out my other book, In Place of Parents, is that the California in the 1960s developed a child welfare computerized system. So before then, every state, every county had their own system. Reports were typed like regular typewriters, and then the state said, "Okay, we're gonna have standardized the reports. We're gonna do this," and they brought social workers, and I had an opportunity to fly. They flew me to Sacramento, and for a day, and I met directly with other social workers and directly with the IBM programmers. This cost the government a lot of money, but the upshot was, it's a really good program, and it has an update like every program. But the structure is now 25 years old, And it, I think that that's what we want to do. Is a little. I use the analogy, build a bridge. You know, do you want to build a bridge for, you know, $20 million that lasts 10 years, or do you want to build a bridge for $30 million that lasts for 50? Oh, obviously, you want to build the 50-year-old bridge, and that's what we need. That's what good government should be about, using also, good use of the staff. Yeah.
I completely agree with that, the best use of the money, but we also can't be using medians for everything. You know, the median house price. The median house price in the county I live in is $430,000. But I paid $52,000 and put $50,000 worth of investment into a four-bedroom house. I've got $100,000 into a house that's now worth $175,000. If government constantly uses the median housing price when they're trying to deal with the poor and with housing crises, they're missing out on things like my beautiful house that just took a little elbow grease and sweat equity. Anyway, Fred in Iowa on line one.
Yeah, hi guys. Have you ever heard of the woman author, Laura Ingalls Wilder, that wrote the book Little House on the Prairie?
Of course, Fred.
I'm familiar with mostly because it's often it mostly comes up as a Jeopardy question, but I've never read the book myself.
Have you heard of it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Serafino, if I'm pronouncing your name correct, have you heard of it?
Yes.
Okay. When I come back from California to Iowa, pardon me, in 2000, I lived a lot of years in California and a lot of years in Alaska. And I was looking for something to read because my mother was a reader, you know. And she suggested Laura Ingalls Wilder, Little House on the Prairie. And I said, well, that's a kid's book. And she said, well, you might like it. So this was 8 o'clock at night, so I started reading it. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was still reading. I finished it. But Laura Ingalls Wilder was born in 1871. But when she was a teacher when she was 15 years old. Then when a kid with a 8th grade, 7th or 8th grade education could teach the constitutional government to an attorney today, that attorneys today don't know a damn thing about the Constitution. It's not taught. And I left school rather early. I didn't finish the 10th grade. I'm 85 years old. My sister and brother went on to college. They're both, you know, millionaires. But for the first 40 years of my life, I made twice the money that they did put together. Well, things changed, and I thought, and I made my money by my back and my muscle, and I'm relatively intelligent. But I felt that things, you know, were so easy for me. Now, I worked hard. I was a tough guy. But I had this attitude, and things come so early, and I was an adventurous person, and I still am today, that I would work as hard for $5 an hour as I would for $100 an hour. But I'd quit a job at $100 an hour just as soon as I would for $5 an hour. But when I worked, I gave it my all. And so I've only got fired once in my life, and that was on the Alaska pipeline, and that was over some bullshite deal. But the thing of it is, I believe strongly. My worldview is a biblical point of view, the Bible. Now, we have lost our principles, our values, our integrity, our honesty, out of ignorance. And to me, the biggest sin, to me, is willful ignorance. Now, we're all ignorant in a lot of things. But the things that count in life, about your values, your principles, your family.
Yeah.
To me, if I personally, mean, if I would... your travels with Christ, God.
Well, but I would. I don't mean to. We need to let you go. Thank you very much for the call. We're getting close to the end, and I want to give Lance a chance to respond. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't give Lance a chance to respond. It's time's up. If you're listening live on Republic Broadcasting Network, please stay tuned for Edge of Darkness with Jeffrey Bennett. Thank you, Lance, for joining us tonight. Please go out and buy his book, Build a Better Bridge. It is worth the read. Thanks to Mike, the producer. Couldn't have done this without you. And thank you most of all to you, the listeners. You're why we do this. Until next week, reject your liberties once they're gone. There's no getting them back. God bless America. And more things made in USA. It's the least we can do for the red, white, and blue. We must take America back. We must take America back.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing. Knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network.
visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.